you all being with us for another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi signing out. See you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome everyone to Youth Station at IRIB English Radio. I'm here with brother Habib and myself Mehdi, and we're talking about something that most youth a large amount or percentage of youth come across when they're hitting their teens and, you know, their 20s, is the thought of suicide. Well, we don't know. Everyone has this different approach and the reason why they come across that thought. But all we know is, well, it has to be dealt with. What do you think?
Of course, my brother. It's a serious situation, and unfortunately, there's a rise in it. And, you know, we see youths at least thinking about it or having a friend who had not only thought about it, but, you know, went into the couple of first steps of it. And I think that, yeah, there are ways to stop, prevent it, and to deal with, you know, to prevent even the thoughts coming to the youth. And even if the thoughts were available, there is a way to, you know, act upon it. And if that unfortunately gets more worse, there's also ways to stop it and whatnot.
Shout out to Sheikh Azhar Nasir from Canada. I saw one of his posts. He was like, when someone commits suicide, instead of arguing whether he's going to go to hell or heaven, think about what happened to the person that suicide was the only option in his mind.
Yes.
You know, what led to that?
Yes, yes. And this concept of, you know, killing oneself and, you know, entering hell right away, it's talked about actually, especially with the bahth, with the topic of al-mustad'af, or the weak in proof. And I think that hopefully the book will finish. There's a book being written in English about this topic. I think it will solve a lot of misconceptions available out there. And like how that brother said, yeah, I think that we should look at the causes of it. What really caused it? Why did he commit suicide? Why doesn't he want his life? One of the most precious things available out there. And, you know, when I say life is precious, it's because look at the most rich people in the world. Those, you know, I'm talking about super wealthy. For example, tell him that you will either have to pay half or three-thirds of your wealth.
Or all of it.
All of it, but to remain alive, he will pay it.
Yeah.
He will pay it. That means that your wealth is not as important as your life. The most precious thing to every human being is their life. And acknowledge this, dear brothers and sisters, that know that your life is also precious for others.
You're right. Yeah.
It's very precious for others, you know? And whether they show it or not, there are people who love you out there. There are people who love you out there. Don't think that one day, if there's no one, I love you. Good?
Yeah.
I'm talking it from all my heart. If there's no one that loves you, I love you. As long as you're a believer in Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, then I love you. And I will defend you with all I got. And your father, your mother, it's enough for them to be happy to see you around, that then take away your own life.
What happens, brother Habib? Like, I saw on the news that a person had committed suicide because he couldn't get an iPhone.
That really, look, sometimes we have to differ between stupid and foolish, and between serious problems.
But like, even the stupid and foolish, was the person valuing that phone more than their life? Like, what's going on? It's insane, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. That it's the lack of knowledge about the importance of life and understanding the purpose of life and understanding the preciousness of life and the significance of life. There's a big difference between that. I personally see that there's a huge difference between that and the person who actually want or committed suicide because they've been oppressed all their lives.
So someone who's oppressed, they're oppressed, but they do not commit suicide. Like, how are they supposed to continue? And is there, like, hope for them?
Of course. Especially those who were abused. I think the better thing is to be abused because, you know, you're abused, you've been abused when you were young, for example, and now you've gone out, it's done. And the best thing about it is to know that when you're being abused is that it's not your fault. I don't know why, but I've had, someone I know personally being abused. And till this day, he thinks that it was his fault. It's not your fault. You were, like, young. You didn't understand. It's not your fault. It's that person's fault. The heat that you should have is the heat of hatred towards that person, yes. But, you know, heat of hating yourself and eating yourself, that you're the person that did that? No, it's not your fault. You always have to keep this in mind. Whether it's abuse, for example, we're talking abuse, or being oppressed, there is always hope for you. And that hope is to actually forget, or that person going into justice. And that person going into justice, trust me, as Muslims, relax from this. It's all in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that person's not going to go away easy.
No way, he's not. But, like, the person who's who has these thoughts, when you speak to them, some of them, they say to you that, you don't know what I'm going through.
It's true. We don't know what you're going through.
You know?
But we're here to help you, and we don't want you to go. You're precious to us. You're mm-hmm. precious to us. Seriously, you're precious to us. You're alive for us. And when you're saying that you don't go through, everyone has their own problems. Sayyid, I think you have your own problems. I have my own problems. Each one has their own problems. And for example, the poor person has specific problems that the rich person doesn't have.
Yeah, and
no
the
one's
other
relaxed.
Way around. Yeah, you're right.
خُلِقَ الْإِنسَانُ فِي كَبَدٍ. It's a human being was created into hardship. Everyone has their hardships. Everyone is going through. Patience is different. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not, give adversary or give, to a person that cannot have patience. Everything is given by their amount of, stability.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I could deal with, for example, losing my entire family, for example. وَلَعِيَاذُ بِاللَّهِ May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect my family. Another person can handle that.
Yeah.
It depends. Each one is like a cup.
Yeah,
like this big one, it's a long time since I've seen a big cup, actually. So it could be like this, or it could be like those small cups, So it could be like the bottle cap of a bottle.
You're right. When you look at Palestinians or people like those,
yeah,
it's excruciating to just
they're losing the land, they're losing their family members. Every family member has at least one
shahid. Houses, everything. And these people are more than ready to live. That is mind-blowing. I don't know what these people have inside
There's
them.
This joke about Arabs and it's that look at the people in Europe that when they fight with their wife, they go into work all gloomy and they're so tired and depressed and whatnot. Look at the Arab. He has an acid reflex in his stomach and he has rent that he still hasn't paid and that they're going to kick him out of his house. He's fighting with his wife. His cousin has passed away and he's sick and he has all these problems and he's sitting down and he's eating sunflower seeds and saying that we need to go on a trip. So it depends. Stereotypes also play a role, actually, Stereotypes play a role, I believe. So, like how we stated, prevention is very important. The Muslim youth have to gain more knowledge. Knowledge is key. Knowledge is key, my brother. I cannot emphasize enough about the importance of knowledge. Like knowing your creator, knowing where you're going after life, why were we created? These simple questions that are in our nature.
Mm.
I'm pretty sure everyone has asked themselves this. What brought me here? Where am I going? Why am I here? Look for this. Search for it. Make it the purpose of your life to look for these until you understand the true purpose of your life. And trust me, when you gain that Islamic ideology, the truth, true understanding, closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, everything will become easy. I'm saying this with certainty.
Leaving suicide becomes easy?
No, not like that, man. I'm saying that there are hardships that you're going through.
Yeah, man.
Hardship. Yeah. We have this, how Sayyidina Zainab alayhi salam. She saw all her, she, not only her brother. We emphasize this a lot in the majalis, that she lost her brother. She lost her children as well.
She lost the Imam of her time.
The Imam of her time, but you know, leave this aspect of her knowledge alone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Salam Allah alayha, alimatun ghayr mu'allama. But look at her as a normal woman. A normal woman in her place.
Yeah.
Leave out Sayyidah Zainab. Just losing, seeing your children beheaded in front of you is enough. Right? And then not only that, you're losing all your family members, you're being imprisoned after you've been royalty. The granddaughter of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, her blood is the blood of the Prophet, and this is the nation of the Prophet taking her as prisoners.
That's a big lesson for us to learn there, man.
You personally, you know, studying Hawza and whatnot, people are gonna look up to you and whatnot, and they're gonna ask you, "I'm thinking about this."
Well,
are you ready to answer such a question?
No, I'm not ready. But there are a few questions, though. For example, if it's someone who does not believe in God, or you know, if they're not Muslim, there's one thing that we can tell them, that you know, I read it somewhere that when you complain about life, remember that there was a time in your life that whatever you wanted was the same way that happened. You know, it was exactly the way you wanted. For example, you know,
like you brought this up to yourself.
A small example: I went to the burger shop and I wanted to be the first in queue. For example, you know, I was the first in the queue, you know, stuff like that. Small things in life, they're things that we don't realize that when things aren't going our way, there was a time that things were going our way.
Yeah, I'm getting the picture.
Yeah, or for example, those times that you couldn't stop laughing, for example. You know,
yeah, there are ups and downs. Life is a roller coaster. That's what you're trying to say, right?
Right. So I'm saying, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. But like, what I'm saying is value those moments, you know? These hardships or a hard life, those few moments that you could cherish, it's worth that life, you know. But if you're a Muslim, it's completely different. If you're a Shia, it's very different. You've got an Imam who loves you more than your mother does, and you're just throwing away your life like that. That's just a completely different thing.
Now, if a person was standing on the bridge, right, and then the police were like, "This person speaks Persian or speaks English, and we don't know how to talk to him." So, brother, Adi Wiyak, go ahead and talk to him. How would you talk to him? How would you start off your conversation with him?
Do you like falafel?
I think that's enough. You know why?
Yeah.
There's something nice about social media, and, you know, Reddit. It lets you talk about personal experiences, and there's this, you know, what made you stop from committing suicide, and one of the answers was that I just wanted someone to talk to.
Wow, that's nice.
You just wanted to talk to. It makes it easier for you to understand, actually, like, oh, okay. So to stop this last step, he's in despair, he has problems, he wants to, you know, he just wants someone to talk to him. And like how you stated, asking one falafel is going to be like, it's going to be either yes, but who says no to falafel? I mean, who says no to falafel?
A person wants to die.
So at the end of the day, you're opening up a conversation with him. Like, you're giving him a chance to talk. Let him understand. And I think that, like what I've read about, actually, those people who are like troubled, they just want someone to talk to. And they want someone to understand them. They want someone to comfort them. That comfort is so valuable. You know, I believe that if we're able to comfort each other, I think that this will prevent it. It will prevent that from happening. Of course, that thought is another problem. Comfort is not enough to, you know, stop that.
We could say or conclude that a person who has these thoughts has to let it out. He has to say, at least express once, that I'm having these thoughts.
Don't bottle it. Sometimes you have to speak. Sometimes you have to talk. Sometimes, you know, give yourself a character. You're a living human being. You're taking space. Don't just take up space. Prove something. You know, talk about it. You know, have confidence in yourself.
And for us,
you know, confidence, unfortunately, is something that a lot of people lack. And unfortunately, it's something easy. It's not that hard, you know. You're not supposed to be an anxiety.
Yeah, easy for you to say.
Everyone is a human being at the end of the day, you know. You know, like how you make your mistakes. We're human beings, for God's sakes. No one should be embarrassed. All of us should be, you know, all of us should be confident about ourselves. Everyone should be able to speak, you know, what they believe in, you know. Like, for example, if I'm in a meeting and then I'm working and they're not going to force me to work. Why should I be forced to work on something I don't want to do? I'll say, I don't want to do this. I want to go to another project, for example.
Yeah, you've got this own identity and you've got your own thought process that you go through. You know, it has to be respected.
Yeah, it has to be respected. And it is respected some way, you know. When you show your confidence, it's like step by step. First time, you're going to see it hard when you show off your confidence. Second time, easier. And then it becomes to a point where it becomes something normal, where you show off your confidence. And I really hope that...
Second nature.
Yeah, I really hope that, you know, those who are struggling gain that confidence, or they need help at least by, you know, getting that confidence. And altogether, suicide is just a long topic, my brother.
From me and my co-host here, Brother Habib, till next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
Israel is undoubtedly an opportunist regime. It once again proved that this week when it escalated demolitions of Palestinian homes as international media were focused on the presidential election in the United States. On Tuesday, the Israeli army carried out the biggest demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank for a decade. It razed to the ground the homes of nearly 80 Palestinians, mostly children, in the Bedouin village of Khirbet Homsa in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli army made sure that nothing was left of the Palestinian structures, which included homes, animal shelters, and solar panels. Palestinians say they had no idea what was about to happen to their homes. The Israelis moved in without prior notice and gave them 10 minutes to evacuate before they started bulldozing. These families are now left homeless and have nowhere to go. Vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinians were also taken away. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya denounced the latest Israeli crime in the occupied territories. Shataya urged the international community to intervene against Israel's attempt to displace the citizens of the Bedouin village and tens of similar Palestinian communities from their homes and lands. The Palestinian premier highlighted the fact that Israel chose Tuesday night to carry out the demolition because global attention was focused on the high-profile vote in America. The demolition drew condemnation from the United Nations and the European Union. So far this year, 689 Palestinian structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says the number is more than the figures in any full year since 2016. Meanwhile, the European Union has highlighted the fact that over 50 Palestinian schools are currently under the threat of Israeli demolition. The Israeli army routinely destroys Palestinian structures in the occupied territories. Anything built without hard-to-get permits, rarely issued by Israel, is at risk of demolition by the Israeli army. Demolition of Palestinian structures and expansion of Israeli settlements are unending. Israeli settlements have been mushrooming in the occupied territories over the past decades. Widespread international condemnation has failed to dissuade the regime from such actions. Pro-Palestinian activists believe even the toughest verbal denunciation do very little to stop such violations of international law. They want the United Nations, the European Union, and other organizations to use their economic leverage with Israel to force the regime to halt its illegal action.
Well, the majority of the EU's exports to the illegal Zionist entity actually come through settlements. So while the EU issues a lot of condemnation of Israel over its illegal settlements, It needs to really put its condemnation into practice by withdrawing from a lot of its economic and bilateral agreements.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the Palestinian cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. As many governments refuse to pressure the regime, Palestinians are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day bear fruit.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in their government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd for 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is of course very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year. And several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are, in fact, at home, not working. But, of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US were more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
It absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who is sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
Yet, as with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failure is a part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet it's something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the U.S. will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say, U.S. domination of the world's people and resources. There may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon. A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the US had exceeded last year's total. By September, the US exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform. Groups that advocate for an end to gun violence say that the surge in firearm sales will only increase the level of domestic violence. According to researchers at the University of California, gun purchases from March to May, linked to the coronavirus pandemic, were also associated with a nearly 8% rise in firearm violence across the United States. That's an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries. With much more ammunition on the streets, there's more fear across the towns and cities of America. A recent report by the Department of Homeland Security says groups and individuals with white supremacist ideologies pose a deadliest terror threat to the United States. Many of these right-wing extremists are armed and have also expressed support for President Trump. The fear is that deadly chaos could ensue if the country's presidential election on Tuesday is disputed by the incumbent. The eldest son of the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King says he fears that the election will bring about another civil war. Martin Luther King III said this is down to the kind of leadership the president has provided.
Without saying it, you know, the president doesn't say that, but he says what he needs to give people comfort in feeling that it's all right for them to say that this is what's going to happen. They themselves have said we're getting prepared for the Civil War. But everybody is buying ammunition, and it's not one side, by the way. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are gunning up.
Gun owners say months of sustained demand for firearms this year has resulted in a shortage of guns and ammunition. Long queues have been seen at gun stores. The highest sales are adding millions of weapons to a nation that already has more guns than people. With increased political polarization, racial tensions, and anger at coronavirus deaths, as well as lockdown restrictions, those post-election fears are not going to disappear.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وبه نستعين إنه خير ناصر ومعين. To talk about how could we live in this world, there are many, many issues would be covered, but for me, some of them are so important, and I've chosen one because it is crucial, and plays the role of engine for moving forward. And that's change happening in this world and our life. What is the meaning of change? How could we actualize the potential change in our life? What is the way for channelizing the change to be beneficial for ourselves? What does Quran say? What does Islam say in this regard? Is there any way prescribed by the Holy Quran to change or not? These are some issues I wanted to start with, and inshallah to go through that topic and reach some points. I don't want to take your time more, but the issue would be covered here is the most important issue that is always coming to a question, and it is under question all the time, and people from different expertise are interested in this issue. The first question: what is change? Is that happening all the time? What is the changing thing? Are the things, all of them, changing? Or some of them are fixed? Could we change whatever we want? Are they all in our hands or not? Some of them are out of our control. The best thing we can start with is the place for changing. To make ourselves in a new position to be pleasant for us. To change whatever is not pleasant for our soul to be so pleasant and joyful. What is the place for that? Is that in the outside? Is that in the inner side of human beings? The many people around the world are seeking change and happiness in the external and real world. Is that the achievement of money, progress in our life, social position, the honorable life and family, the dignity that we can own? What is changing our life? What is bringing change to us? According to the Holy Quran, there is one great verse that is calling people to change, but the correct place for change is not external world, that is inside of you. What is inside is real change. I do remember one of the Christian scholars, he was one of the bishops, and was in a deathbed, was talking as a final will for his children. He said, when I was a young boy, I was thinking about changing world, because old priests, religious scholar all the time, interested in changing the world to the best one, in reforming what is not pleasant, what is not compatible with religious teachings. Little by little, when I grew up, I noticed that changing the world, such a huge world, great world, is not so possible for me. It's better to focus on one continent. For example, America, or Europe, or Asia, Africa. When I grew up enough and reached my middle age, I noticed and realized that, oh, this is so heavy mission over my shoulder, I cannot change even one continent. It's better to focus on one country, because changing one country is much more easier than the continent or the world. So I go forward in my age and reach the age of perfection and realized that, oh, changing the country is also difficult for me. It's better to focus on one city that I'm living in. And after one city, I found that this is so difficult as well. I cannot change the city. It's better to change the family. Okay? My spouse, my children. If I change these people, just few people, so that I think that can I change the world. And now I'm dying and reach new point. And that is, if from the beginning I focus on changing myself, it was possible for me to change the world, entire world. But now I'm realizing, finding myself that I'm not, you know, planned enough for myself, and I'm forgotten by myself, then nothing happened. No change happened in my life.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So the Holy Quran mentions this approach by saying that people who are seeking some change, it's better to focus on themselves. This is not nature changing everything. This is ourselves. We can change, but what? Whatever is inside of us, what is inside is changing. And we can own our own capacities, faculties of souls, whatever, you know, exists in our soul, we are owning, can control, can change. Whoever changes his self or herself can change the real world. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُغَيِّرُ مَا بِقَوْمٍ حَتَّى يُغَيِّرُ مَا بِأَنفُسِهِ. Allah the Almighty doesn't change the existence, the situation, condition for people, nations, unless they themselves change whatever exists inside them. You want to reach happiness? Change your attitudes toward happiness. Inshallah, I ask Allah the Almighty to put us among the people, travelers, wayfarers toward Allah the Almighty, who were perfect people, such as Ahlul Bayt, such as Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, and the other prophets, previous prophets, and enable us to change the situation that we live to the best one, inshallah rahman. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillah rabbil alameen. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
فرشي التراب يضمني وهو غطائي، حولي الرمال تلفني بل من ورائي، واللحد يحكي ظلمة
فيها ابتلائي والنور خط كتابه أنسي لقائي أنسي لقائي والأهل أين حنانهم باعوا وفائي والصحب أين جموعهم تركوا إخائي تركوا إخائي إخائي والمال أين هناؤه صار ورائي والاسم أين بريقه ليل الثنا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Deutsche Bank is searching for a way to end its relationship with U.S. President Donald Trump after the election following years of negative media coverage stemming from their relationship, a new report reveals. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Igor Derish Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Deutsche Bank may seize Trump's assets if he loses and fails to repay debt. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Deutsche Bank is searching for a way to end its relationship with U.S. President Donald Trump after the election following years of negative media coverage stemming from their relationship, a new report reveals. Trump has long relied heavily on the German-based financial giant, and he currently owes the bank about $340 million. Bank officials concerned about the president's ability to repay the loans have discussed foreclosing on his properties or even seizing his assets, according to Reuters. Deutsche Bank was one of few financial firms willing to do business with Trump after a series of bankruptcies and defaults in the 90s, lending the president more than $2 billion over the two decades. The bank continued to lend Trump hundreds of millions even after he sued it for predatory lending practices and fought for forgiveness for his unpaid debt, according to the New York Times. Trump has about $340 million in outstanding loans to the Trump Organization, which he has personally guaranteed that come due in 2023 and 2024. But Deutsche Bank executives have met to discuss ways to end their relationship with Trump, according to Reuters. The bank's management committee overseeing reputational risks for the company in the Americas has floated an idea to sell off Trump's debt on the secondary market, as it did in the past. However, the idea has failed to gain traction because it is not clear who would want to buy the loans and the attendant problems that come with it, according to the report. Executives tried of the negative publicity and legal scrutiny believe they will have more freedom to sever their relationship with Trump if he loses the election, which they hope will ease congressional scrutiny of the bank if Democrats win the Senate. Deutsche Bank has already faced numerous federal and local investigations into its dealings with Trump, which one senior executive described as serious collateral damage for his long-time relationship, according to Reuters. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who sits on the Senate Banking Committee, has vowed to investigate the bank over its relationship with the Trump family. Such a probe would face fewer roadblocks if Democrats win back control of the upper chamber. Executives are also concerned about Trump's ability to repay his debts. The loans were given for the development of his Doral Golf Resort and hotels in Chicago and Washington. But those properties were already struggling from Trump's drag on their business before the coronavirus pandemic dealt a serious blow to the hospitality industry. If Trump is no longer in office, Deutsche Bank executives believe it will be easier to demand repayment, according to Reuters. The bank could also refinance the debt, foreclose on the properties if it does not pay or seize the president's assets if he is unable to repay, two officials told Reuters. The executives believe they will have less recourse if the president wins re-election. The bank wouldn't want the negative publicity inherent with seizing assets from a sitting president and would likely extend the loans until he is out of office, the outlet reported. The Deutsche Bank loans are just a fraction of Trump's overall debt. The New York Times, which obtained years of Trump's personal and business tax returns, reported that his company is on the hook for $421 million in loans that were personally guaranteed. A Forbes analysis found that Trump's company has more than $1 billion in debt. Trump has argued that his debt is dwarfed by the size of his personal wealth, but he has been unable or unwilling to pay back his full debt to Deutsche Bank and other lenders in the past. He also defaulted on bonds the bank helped sell to investors finance his failed Atlantic City properties. The president has also infamously refused to pay his debts to vendors and contractors throughout much of his career. That attitude was on full display when he had issues with his microphone recently at one of his final campaign rallies in Kenosha, Wisconsin. "Don't pay him. Don't pay damn bill," Trump shouted while ranting about the sound guy, adding, "And then I won't pay the bill of the company that does this crazy microphone, and they will do story. Trump is a horrible human being. He doesn't pay bill. No, I don't like to pay bills when people do a bad job."
ربنا ربنا ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining a question regarding the relationship between God's essence and his attributes. This is a very tricky problem. Unfortunately, it's a question that naturally arises in the minds of anybody who is somewhat associated with religion and has an acquaintance with religious texts. Because in any religious text, regardless of whether it's the Quran or the Bible or even a text of some Far Eastern religion, these religious texts ascribe attributes to God. They describe him as having power. They describe him as having life, as having knowledge. The natural question that arises in the mind is, what is the nature of the relationship between these attributes and the essence of God? Are they external to his essence? Are they internal to him? If they're internal to him, are they parts of his essence? Or are they one with his essence, identical to it? What's going on here, and how can we explain this without it leading to some kind of objection? One of the views which has been mentioned here is the idea that these attributes are conceptually distinct from one another, but they're identical with God's essence in the external world. It's possible for somebody to ask, how is this possible? Would this not lead to a contradiction? This would mean that one thing would be simultaneously one and multiple and numerous at the same time. Isn't this impossible? Meaning, when we say that one thing, something is one, it means that it's not numerous, it's not multiple. When we say that something is numerous and multiple, it means that it's not one. So you're saying, if we say that something is one and at the same time it's numerous, it means that it's one and it's not one. It's multiple and it's not multiple. It's numerous and it's not numerous. This is a contradiction. The answer to this problem is really quite simple. And that's this: in order for two propositions, two statements, two sentences to contradict one another, it's necessary for a certain number of clauses and conditions within the two statements to be the same. Let me give you an example that can help clarify this. Like, for example, if I said Zayd doesn't have a beard, and Zayd has a beard, these two statements don't contradict one another if the clauses within them are different. For example, if I say Zayd, when he is a child, doesn't have a beard, but Zayd, when he became a man, he has a beard. Well, these statements don't contradict one another. Why? Because the clauses present within them are distinct from one another. In order for them to contradict one another, it's necessary for the clauses to be the same. Yeah, if I say that Zayd, when he is a boy, doesn't have a beard, and Zayd, when he's a boy, has a beard, will these contradict one another? Or if I say that Zayd, in America, he's an American citizen. But when he moved to Iran, he became an Iranian citizen. Well, these statements don't contradict one another, because two of the clauses mentioned within here, within these two statements, are distinct. In a similar fashion, when we say that the attributes and the essence of God are distinct from one another and are multiple, we refer to this in the mind. This multiplicity occurs in the mind, in mental analysis. However, when we say that these attributes and the essence of God are identical and are united and are one, it refers to the external world. These concepts are one and identical with one another and united with each other in the external world, not in mental analysis and in the mind. So these two statements don't contradict one another. There's no contradiction involved. Until next time, thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the nature of God's attributes and its relation and their relation with God's essence. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
www.parstoday.com/en.